No, it's not Flashpoints. It's off today. Instead, we'll be hearing Law and Disorder. Co-host Michael Ratner and Michael Smith talk about their book, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. And we hear about former Chicago police commander John Burge, who was convicted of lying about torturing more than 100 African-American men at Chicago police stations. He was recently released from prison. At 11 on Between the Covers, National Book Award winner Richard Powers discusses his latest novel, Orfeo, about modern music and the horrors of the national security state. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, filmmaker Toby Froud explains how a new generation is helping keep the art of puppet animation fresh. Dal Halstead talks about the Hollywood Theater's move to bring 70mm film screenings back to Portland. And OMSI's Christy Pizzio and Russ Rep, talk about the local museum's current animation exhibition. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO, but first it's Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. That's next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland performance of Carla Lara, Thursday, October 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m., Carla Lara, Honduran jazz singer, songwriter, and political activist, will be performing at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. She is a working artist, journalist, and feminist in a country where resistance in her artistic life has always been tied to political life in Central America. That's Carla Lara, Thursday, October 23rd, from 7 to 10 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Slip a bookmark into your paperback and listen to KBOO for interviews with your favorite fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. World Socialists, WSWS.org. Andre Damon reports 47% of Americans have incomes under twice the official poverty rate, making half of the country either poor or near poor, according to figures released last week by the Census Bureau. These figures are based on the Census Bureau's Supplemental Poverty Measure, or the SPM, which takes into account government transfers and the regional cost of living in calculating the poverty rate. According to that calculation, which you can bet is going to be lowballing it, there were 48.7 million people in poverty in the United States, 3 million higher than the official census figures released last month. The U.S. poverty rate, according to the SBM, was 15.5%. The release of these figures, as well as last month's official poverty figures, have been greeted with silence in the media, despite the fact that the U.S. is a mere 2 weeks away from a midterm election. As with every major social and political question, the issues of poverty and social inequality are being totally excluded from debate and discussion in the elections and ignored by the two big business parties. And Andre Damon writes further, the figures follow the release of a series of reports and studies documenting the growth of social inequality in the United States. Last week, Credit Suisse reported that the top 1% of the world's population controls nearly half of all wealth, and the United States has nearly 10 times more super wealthy people than any other country. The census figures show that poverty is still a major problem in the U.S., and that's according to Christopher Weimer, co-director of the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. He said the SPM begins with a slightly higher poverty threshold than the official poverty figure, and then adjusts it based on the local cost of living and the prices of necessities of life. As a result, both the poverty rate and the number of people in poverty are slightly higher than under the official poverty figure. So you can find more on that at WSWS.org. From Radio Havana, Cuba, Cuban President Raul Castro saw off an 83-member medical brigade that will fight Ebola in Africa, particularly in Liberia and Guinea-Conakry, two nations hit hard by poverty and the lack of resources to deal with the growing epidemic. The brigade is made up of 35 physicians and 48 nurses who expressed their commitment to offer their services and take all established safety measures, according to this morning's edition of Granma, the newspaper. All professionals with the brigade have over 15 years' experience, while 42% of them have served on this kind of medical mission before. With this brigade, Cuba has now 256 medical professionals in West Africa as part of its commitment to health and humanity. Guess how many, by the way, how many medical professionals does the U.S. officially have in West Africa? I'll give you a hint. The number starts with a Z. Also from Radio Havana, Cuba is willing to work with the United States in the fight against Ebola, according to President Raul Castro. He said, we believe that we must avoid any politicization of this grave problem that would distract us from the fundamental objective, which is helping confront this epidemic. He said, Cuba is willing to work shoulder to shoulder with all other countries, including the United States. End quotes. On Tuesday, Cuba sent 83 more medical staff to the epicenter of the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. The doctors and nurses going to Guinea and Liberia joined the 165 already in Sierra Leone, making the island of 11 million people one of the largest global contributors of medical workers to the fight against Ebola. The volunteers are all men and have at least 20 years of experience each, have completed several missions overseas, and are married with children. Latest on, latest on Fukushima radiation nearing this coast. Actually, there's information from the Statesman Journal, an article by Tracy Lowe. She writes, radiation from Japan's Fukushima nuclear disaster is approaching the West Coast. And that's according to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, a sample taken August 2nd, about 1,200 kilometers west of Vancouver, B.C., tested positive for cesium-134, the Fukushima fingerprint. It showed higher than background levels of cesium-137, another Fukushima isotope that's already present in the world's oceans from nuclear testing in the 50s and 60s. The sample is the first of about 40 offshore test results that will be made public next month. That's according to Ken Buesler, a chemical oceanographer at Woods Hole Institute. Further results, which Buesler will release at a conference November 13th, will show offshore Fukushima radiation down the coast into California, he said, including some samples that are closer to shore. He emphasized the radiation is at very low levels right now. I'm not concerned, he said, and no samples from West Coast shorelines have found Fukushima radiation. There is definitely offshore Fukushima cesium now, Buesler said. It's not on the beaches, but it's offshore. Massive amounts of contaminated water released from Fukushima following a March 2011 earthquake and tsunami. Radioactive waters continue to leak and to be released from the complex. Now, departing from this, this is the latest news on a massive amount of radiation that is very slowly coming towards the West Coast. And pardon me, and this confirms that it is making its way across. And of course, right now, the amounts are very, very small. It's just the very edge of it gets across. But this is a story that needs to be covered over a period of many years, and so I'm determined not to lose track of it. Pleased to hear and to be able to say to you that the coast is still clear. However, that will change, I'm sorry to say. And this cesium and strontium and ruthenium and all these other radioactive substances are on the way. Buesler said he hesitated to test the samples at first because analyzing them would have cost about $30,000 his lab didn't have. He said, we decided to send the containers anyway, Buesler was able to use a $12,000 donation from UK-based Lush Fresh Handmade Cosmetics to begin processing the samples. He's still looking for funding to make up the difference. And once again, speaking for myself, this reflects the fact that the United States government really is very, very, very pointedly uninterested in tracking this plume of radiation. And so Woods Hole Institute is depending on volunteers and on donations. How ridiculous is that? Just as ridiculous as it needs to be to support the nuclear power industry, which, after all, is the pet of very, very rich people. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. From Human Rights Watch, the Ukrainian government forces used cluster munitions in populated areas in Donetsk City in early October this year. That's according to Human Rights Watch. They say the use of cluster munitions in populated areas violates the laws of war due to the indiscriminate nature of the weapon and may amount to war crimes. And turning from that text, we're talking about big canisters of little bitty bombs, and each of the little bitty bombs goes off. Well, not each of them. Most of them go off. These are really insidious weapons, and they are war crimes. And the Uncle Sam's friends, the Ukrainian Nazis, no kidding, who are in charge of the armed forces of Ukraine, have been using this to try to tip the scales their way as they fight against the cities that are more pro-Russian and who don't want to be part of the Nazi-led pro-U.S. government. And these bombs have the additional quality. Now, some of the munitions intentionally don't go off, so that they'll lay around and create sort of mines and make a no-go area. They're also really handy for blowing up children, because children tend to pick them up. This is why they are a war crime. Returning to the text from Human Rights Watch, hrw.org, you can find it there. During a week-long investigation in eastern Ukraine, Human Rights Watch documented widespread use of cluster munitions and fighting between government forces and pro-Russian rebels in more than a dozen urban and rural locations. While it was not possible to conclusively determine responsibility for many of the attacks, the evidence points to the Ukrainian government forces' responsibility for several cluster munition attacks on Donetsk. An employee of the International Committee of the Red Cross was killed on October 2nd in an attack on Donetsk that included the use of cluster munition rockets. It's Press Watch. It's 9:12 Pacific time. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is KBOO Portland. Now, the rest of the show, I need to talk about the situation with Ebola. I've seen articles in the press talking about how you're much more likely to get tuberculosis, which is true, much more likely to get run over, which is true. You're much more likely to get shot with a gun, which is true, much more likely to die from alcohol. All of this is true right now, but the numbers are not the story. Of course, the problem with Ebola is its astonishing transmissibility and its deadliness. And saying that, oh, only three people are infected and one dead, or what? That's not quite exactly right. Maybe it's three dead, but saying that the number of people who have died in the United States is tiny, and therefore you don't need to be concerned, is very misleading. It would be like saying, do you remember... I guess you'd have to be pretty old like me to actually remember seeing these cartoons on television. So maybe you've seen it on YouTube or something. Old Yosemite Sam cartoons where part of the joke is powder is strewn from a keg to make a sort of pirate fuse. And, of course, it gets lit and blows people up. And it would be like saying if Yosemite Sam was around and... had thrown a match onto a trail of gunpowder leading to a keg. On the first nanosecond, well, heck, only a few molecules have been lit up. That's only 1/10,000,000% of the total weight of the keg, and so there's no cause for concern. But that wouldn't be true, would it? Because there's a contagion involved and an explosion to follow, and this is the whole problem. And this is what we're faced with now. So turning to breaking news on Ebola, from Reuters, Connecticut placed six West Africans who arrived in the United States under quarantine for a possible Ebola exposure, a move that comes as the United States starts new restrictions on those coming in for the country's hardest hit by the deadly virus. The family of six West Africans who arrived Saturday and were planning to live in the United States will be watched for 21 days, according to Connecticut state health authorities. They said that this morning. Officials have yet to say where the family comes from. Fears about the spread of Ebola, which has killed At least 4,900 people in Liberia, Sierra Leone, there, and Guinea have surmounted in the United States since the first man diagnosed with the disease was hospitalized in Texas in late September. So there's more on that Reuters article, and you can find it there. Article from Natural News says an expert scientist from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, or NIAID, has publicly warned that the Ebola strain currently in circulation appears to be far more virulent and infectious than previous strains. Kind of a super Ebola. Returning to the Texas, says Dr. Peter Yarling has been on the ground in Liberian capital of Monrovia, studying the disease with a team of researchers, which is also helping to care for and treat patients. He says the viral loads that his team is witnessing exceed what has been observed during previous outbreaks, suggesting that this time the disease is far more deadly. Echoing the warnings given by others, Dr. Yarling believes that this strain of Ebola is not only more deadly than other strains, but also mutating at an alarming rate. More of the virus is infecting patients and appears to be advancing and spreading more rapidly than usual. Quoting Yarling, we're using tests now that weren't used in the past, but there seems to be a belief that the virus load is higher in these patients today than what we have seen before. If true, that is a very different bug. He said, I have a field team in Monrovia. They're running tests. They're telling me that viral loads are coming up very quickly and really high, higher than they are used to seeing. It may be that this virus burns hotter and quicker. So I have a number of questions about Ebola. And just a few of them are, when it was apparent that this was a large for Ebola outbreak back in, say, April, why were no hospital ships sent? Why did they refuse? Why is there this slowness to the response? Were they afraid of Ebola or just unconcerned? They said that they were actually afraid of Ebola, or at least one hospital ship spokesperson was in the press saying that. A second question, why are the CDC, Obama, and the press insisting that Ebola is hard to transmit when it's obviously easy to transmit? Why are they lying? Why are they lying? Why clear out apartments if it doesn't stay viable on surfaces? Another question, why is this Ebola so much more virulent? Is it bioengineered? More on this in a minute. Why is the work in Liberia not being done by construction brigades? They're notoriously swift, efficient. They certainly helped win the war in the Pacific in the middle of the last century. They're still around. They're still swift and efficient. More slowness. And then there's this from Henry Nyman, who I've interviewed here on Press Watch on KBOO, who writes the Recombinomics.org blog, or it's Recombinomics.com. He says the regarding the situation with Eric Duncan, who died in Dallas, the World Health Organization has cited the use of convalescent blood or plasma to treat patients and posted a detailed 2014 report on its Ebola website entitled Use of Convalescent Whole Blood or Plasma Collected from Patients Recovered from Ebola Virus Disease for Transfusion as an Empirical Treatment During Outbreaks. And the report addresses ABO mismatches as blood types. When it is not possible, they say, to test the patient's ABO group, or if ABO matched is not available then, recommends using whole blood if the donor is type O, and to use plasma for this type of inoculation if the donor is type AB, A, or B, since plasma has had the blood cells removed. Now, the reason he's talking about that is that it was said that he was not a match, but this is not an appropriate answer since he could have been treated with plasma. And Nyman writes, indeed, Dr. Kent Brantley was treated with convalescent antibodies from a recovered case in Liberia, and he was the donor for three cases treated in Nebraska, as well as for the healthcare worker in Texas, Nina Pham. Media reports characterize one or more of these treatments as a plasma infusion, suggesting an ABO mismatch, which would preclude a whole blood transfusion, but not a plasma transfusion. So, once again, speaking for myself, this is relevant because we are told that, well, it just couldn't happen. But this, so returning to the text, this failure to treat with convalescent antibody follows a failure to admit When Eric Duncan made his initial visit to Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital on the evening of September 25th, although he had a low-grade fever when he arrived, when he left 4 hours later, he had a fever of 103 Fahrenheit and was sent home with antibiotics and Tylenol. Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital has been cited for the past 3 years for having a high frequency of ER discharges, which returned within 30 days. And Eric Duncan fit that pattern when he returned on September 28th after a contact called 911, which led to ambulance transport. By then, Eric Duncan also had diarrhea and vomiting, but his blood was not sent out for Ebola testing until the next day, Monday, September 29th, and media reports indicated his nephew called the CDC on Monday due to a lack of progress. From Dr. Henry Nyman, and under the category, what the hell? Returning to the text, although Eric Duncan was lab confirmed on Tuesday, September 30th, by CDC in Atlanta and the Texas State Lab in Austin, he was not treated with convalescent antibodies, even though Kent Brantley was willing to donate. Moreover, experimental drug treatment was delayed until Duncan suffered organ failure and was placed on life support involving intubation and dialysis. The withheld antibodies and late treatment may have contributed to the patient's deterioration, which was likely associated with an increased viral load, which may have played a role in the infection of Nina Pham. More detail on the apparent failure to follow World Health Organization advice on the use of convalescent plasma on recipients which do not match the donor, and why the treatment of Eric Duncan was characterized as impeccable would be useful. You can find that commentary at Recombinomics.com. You're listening to Press Watch. It's 20 minutes after 9 o'clock. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and this is KBOO Portland. The United States, according to RT.com, has withheld assurances from Germany that the Ebola virus, among other related diseases, would not be weaponized in the event of Germany exporting it to the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases. German MFA Deputy Head of Division for Export Control Markus Klinger provided a paper to the U.S. Consulate's Economics Office seeking additional assurances related to a proposed export of extremely dangerous pathogens. Germany subsequently made two follow-up requests and clarifications to the Army. According to the unclassified WikiLeaks cable, quoting, this matter concerns the complete genome of viruses such as Zaire Ebola virus, the Lake Victoria Marburg virus, the Machupo virus, and the Lassa virus, which are absolutely amongst the most dangerous pathogens in the world, end quote. The Zaire Ebola virus was the same strain of Ebola virus which has been rampaging through West Africa in recent months. The delivery, quoting the cable, would place the recipient in the position of being able to create replicating recombinant infectious species of these viruses, end quote. Just want to repeat that. Would place the recipient in the position of being able to create replicating recombinant infectious species of these viruses. Following with the text, it says, and this is from Russia Today, however, it also points out that Germany has in place an exceptionally restrictive policy, adding that approval would not be granted to the export until U.S. assurance was provided. Quoting, a decision about the export has not yet been made. Given the foregoing, we'd appreciate confirmation that the in-use certificate really is from the Department of the Army and of the accuracy of the data contained therein. So there's more on that at Russia Today, RT.com. They note that bioweapons were outlawed in the Biological Weapons Convention of 1972 and signed and ratified by 179 signatories, including Germany, the U.S., and Russia. So, received information, and thanks to AM News and Public Affairs producer Kathleen Stevenson for passing it on to me, a collection of information from accuracy.org about this question of just how related this outbreak of Ebola may be to U.S. biowarfare efforts. And so I want to continue with that. The number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And the topic is Ebola, and I have more information about U.S. bioweapons labs and Ebola. And Thomas is on the air. What's up, Thomas?
Yeah, good morning. I would submit that the reason why poor Mr. Duncan was pretty much doomed to die in that Texas hospital is essentially the same reason why 30 or 40,000 other people who are Americans die in U.S. hospitals every year, and that is that he didn't have the good old insurance bill to pay for it, to pay for the blood transfusion, which saved the life of the two high-profile missionary medical people that were treated in Atlanta. But, of course, that's high-profile, and they're white and Christian, and it's a matter of national pride. And, of course, the poor nurses that were infected, of course, that's a matter of pride, too. Can't have that. Bad for morale, but, you know, an average person, a plebe, particularly a foreigner, my goodness. You know, and I think, you know, you can look at that, and it's reflected on the national and international level. I understand that there was supposed to be some large fund set up, I believe, under the WHO. I believe I had that correct, but at any rate, the point stands is that there's some large fund to fight Ebola, and Western countries pledged something like, what was it, into the billions, and so far, as of last week, at least $100,000. So not even half the price of one moldering 100-year-old Portland two-bedroom home has been pledged by the entire world to fight this. No, I think it's, you know, we shows how little United States cares. And then also about our own citizens. Think about it. I mean, I've been talking about this for 15 years. The United States, now thank God that so far at least the Ebola is not allegedly transmissible through has not changed to where it's admissible or transmissible through the air like the flu is. If we ever had a pandemic flu here, what would we do? I mean, our market-based healthcare system, we've completely slashed over the last 30 years the hospitals. Almost all of the old religious-run or charity hospitals have been shut down. There's almost no extra bed capacity, which is the thing that a modern society that cares about its citizens does, is keeps extra beds and capacity in hospitals to deal with crises. We don't have that, you know, and think about this. We don't have, we have this ancient, antiquated, and creaking vaccine development system because guess what? All the pharmaceutical companies are, even though they're funded massively through the university research, They don't want to do anything with vaccines because it's not profitable. So, really, you know, you want to talk about homeland insecurity. You want to talk about a danger to where millions of people could die in a plausible scenario that could easily happen at any point, particularly given the fact that no one on this planet is more than a 15-hour jet ride from anywhere else on the planet. No, this shows you that the people at the top in our country and internationally do not care. They sit in their insular shields, and play chess games with people's lives, play chess games with our lives, and when it affects their sense of pride, then they do something about it. Or when, heaven forbid, one of their children might have a remote possibility of getting something, then they do something about it. I think it's a call of shame, and I hope, if nothing else, shame will drive people to try to put some pressure to get some of these this help. This is really bad. This is an absolute tragedy.
Thank you very much for your call. The number to call, 503-231-8187. From Actually.org, the question, are U.S. bioweapons labs the solution or the problem? They write, on Friday, the New York Times published the article, White House to Cut Funding for a Risky Biological Study, which states, quote, prompted by controversy over dangerous research and recent laboratory accidents, the White House announced Friday it would temporarily halt all new funding for experiments that seek to study certain infectious agents by making them more dangerous, end quote. The piece quotes Richard H. Ebright, a molecular biologist and bioweapons expert at Rutgers University, who has argued that a long history of accidental releases of infectious agents from research labs make such work extremely risky and unwise to perform in the first place. Dr. Ebright calls Friday's announcement an important, albeit overdue, step. And there is an article from USA Today, and I'm going to have to really shuffle through my pages to find it, about how many accidents there have been. And it raises the question of whether this highly infectious and different Ebola has actually come from such an accident. And that's called Hundreds of Bioterror Lab Mishaps Cloaked in Secrecy. And let's see, I think I have that. Yes. Names of the labs under that article. that have had mishaps or made mistakes, as well as most information about all of the incidents, must be kept secret because of federal bioterrorism laws, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which regulates the labs and co-authored the annual lab incident reports with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And that's an article by Allison Young in, of all places, USA Today. It starts off saying more than 1,100 laboratory incidents involving potential bioterror germs were reported to federal regulators during 2008 through 2012. Let me just restate that. This is an article by Allison Young in USA Today, usatoday.com. It starts off saying more than 1,100 laboratory incidents involving potential bioterror germs were reported to federal regulators during 2008 through 2012. Details of what happened are cloaked in secrecy. More than 1,100 laboratory incidents involving bacteria, viruses, and toxins that pose significant or bioterror risks to people and agriculture were reported to federal regulators during 2008 through 2012. More than half these incidents were serious enough that lab workers received medical evaluations or treatment, according to the reports. And as I've said in past weeks on this program, the U.S. has been experimenting with Ebola and other diseases, and has been doing so in a grand way, especially since the Bush administration. Number to call with your comments or questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Earlier this summer, other researchers at the CDC potentially exposed dozens of agency staff to live anthrax because of mistakes. Nobody was sickened. Meanwhile, at the National Institutes of Health, long-forgotten vials of deadly smallpox virus were discovered in a cold storage room where they weren't supposed to be. Much more information on that in a moment, but right now I'll talk to Jack. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Hello, Jack.
Hi. In response to Thomas, who always has extensive insight, I think he's a little bit perhaps too forgiving. I would suggest there we may be looking at a population reduction program, and this can be related to other things. In particular, we have this history of the use of depleted uranium all throughout the Middle East, all the way from the Balkans to Afghanistan to the Sahel, and used very often in places where there is no armor for this armor-piercing munition to face. Yes, at the beginning of Gulf War One, at the beginning of Iraq Two, there was the Iraqi